From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. Today, the first bourbon whiskey made from Iowa corn and distilled in the state since the end of Prohibition makes its debut. In the first half hour, we'll find out why Cedar Ridge Vineyards Winery and Distillery of Swisher decided to launch the new Iowa bourbon. Then in the second half hour, we travel back to the Prohibition era in the Midwest with Jonathan Eig. His new biography is titled Get Capone, the secret plot that captured America's most wanted gangster. Eig is the first writer to draw on thousands of pages of previously untapped documents. He'll also tell us about Al Capone's bootleg liquor connections in Iowa. That's all coming up. First, a look at this hour's news. It's The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In the second half hour of our show today, we travel back to the Prohibition era in the Midwest with award-winning biographer Jonathan Eig. Get Capone is the title of his new biography. Eig is the first writer to draw on thousands of pages of previously untapped documents in telling Al Capone's rise and fall. He'll also tell us about Al Capone's bootleg liquor connections in Iowa. But before that, the first bourbon whiskey made from Iowa corn and distilled in the state since the end of Prohibition is making its debut today, July 1st. Iowa Bourbon Whiskey is the latest product created by a Bavarian pot still at Cedar Ridge Vineyards Winery and Distillery. That's in Swisher, Iowa. Joining us to discuss Iowa's newest distilled spirits, Jeff Quint, president and owner of Cedar Ridge Vineyards, in our studio in Iowa City. Welcome to you, Jeff.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
Also joining us by phone, Garrett Burchett. He is one of the investors in the Mississippi River Distilling Company in LeClaire, Iowa. Not yet in production, a planned distillery. We'll talk to you in a minute, Garrett, but first of all, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Jeff, the first bourbon whiskey made from Iowa corn, distilled in the state since the end of Prohibition, making its debut today. Why did you decide to launch this product?
Well, we started distilling back in 2005, and we were distilling a variety of mostly clear products at that point in time. When a product comes out of the still, it's clear, and for instance, vodka and gin, you can basically sell them almost immediately after they come out of the still. So when we started the business, we had to get product on the market as soon as possible. But we've always had in the back of our mind that really bourbon is the right product for the state of Iowa, because bourbon is made from at least 51% corn. So here we sit in the corn state. And
by definition, anything called bourbon that anybody finds on any shelf across the country is at least 51%.
That's by federal law, by federal definition. Yep. In order to be bourbon, it has to be made from at least 51% corn.
Mm-hmm. And Iowa bourbon whiskey, the new whiskey, is how much corn goes into that?
Our bourbon is running between 70 and 75% corn. Mm-hmm. And then the balance is some malted barley and rye. Mm-hmm. So usually you have a choice between rye or wheat as that third element, and we've chosen rye. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. July 1st is its debut today. What does that mean? Are you so it will be first time available where?
Yeah, well, two things going on today. First of all, today is when we release the bourbon statewide. And then also today is the day that a law changed that is significant to us, in that we can, as of today, as a distillery, we can sell two bottles to any given visitor on any given day at the distillery. So that's a significant event. You know, I'm sure we can talk more about that.
Well, let's do that right now, because we've talked about this on previous shows. This was a curiosity of Iowa. So to, wine, for instance, you have a vineyard, you produce a wine, you can have people tour, and they could buy wine after the tour on site. Not so with distilled spirits up to this point.
That's right. Wine and beer, both breweries can sell their beer on premise. We have been working on that law change for, this was the fifth session and we got it passed, so 5 years. And when I say we, Scott Bush from Templeton Rye was also active with us in getting the law changed. And really, it kind of evens the playing field a little bit with breweries and wineries. But one difference is they can consume the beer and the wine on premise. With the distillery, you can sell it there, but the product is not to be consumed on premise, other than samples that we can provide when they're there. Mm-hmm.
And so what was holding this law up all this point, this law change, this exclusion of distilled hard liquor from selling it on site?
The fact that we're a control state in Iowa, all alcohol, and we continue to be a control state, all alcohol that's consumed in Iowa goes through our state warehouse. Every drop of spirits sold in the state at one point makes its way through Ankeny, Iowa, through the state-owned warehouse, and that's where the state marks up the spirits and essentially gains their tax dollars on it. So I think there's always been a concern that, we need to keep an eye on and control the handling of this alcohol so that the state makes sure that nothing, no improprieties are experienced and, that we don't get in some kind of a bootlegging situation. So we had to modify how the law was written in this last session in order to get the law passed at all. And the way it was modified is we still – send the spirits to the state warehouse, and then they bring them back to us.
So they go from your distillery to Ankeny, Iowa, then are shipped back after they get that stamp on them or the label.
Yep, and that's really just so that everyone's treated the same in terms of all other spirits that come into the state that are being imported, which until us was 100% of the spirits. They do have to go through the warehouse. So, I can see, I understand the logic behind why we have to do that.
Some people might not understand, Jeff Quint, why this would make such a big difference, that someone visiting your distillery, your vineyard, can walk away with two bottles of the distilled spirits, in this case the Iowa bourbon whiskey. What difference does that make?
Well, I think it makes a big difference. It seems maybe insignificant, but I think you're going to see a significant impact in the state.
In what ways?
You now have probably the last reason you need really to come visit the distillery. You get to take a tour of the distillery and watch us making product. You get to sample the products, and now you can actually leave with a couple bottles. Mm-hmm. So I think, if you go to other states, Kentucky being a great example, you go on tours, and at the end you end up in the sales room, and you sample some products, and you end up taking away a couple bottles. I think it's good for the state because now visitors from out of state can walk away with a couple bottles and a great experience. And, it really goes back to Iowa being the corn state, and literally we've been importing all of the $300 million a year worth of spirits that we consume in this state, and we should be an exporter. And I think this is going to spawn, when you get to Garrett here in a minute, it's going to spawn hopefully many new distilleries, and 10 or 15 years from now you'll see us exporting products instead of importing them.
Jeff Quint is the president and owner of Cedar Ridge Vineyards Winery and Distillery, located in Swisher, Iowa. Garrett Burchett, you're one of the investors in the Mississippi River Distilling Company in LeClaire, Iowa. This will be, I understand, the planned Mississippi River Distilling Company will be just off I-80 near the Quad Cities. Is that right?
It'll be near the Quad Cities. I guess we'll be in downtown LeClaire. We hope to be open. We started construction here, and we hope to be open here in December.
Mm-hmm. And what will you be making?
Similar to what Jeff was discussing, our intent is to start with the clear spirits, like vodka and gin, and move into a bourbon or a whiskey, with age. Some of the things that we've also discussed, is some seasonals based on, what farmers are producing. If someone was doing strawberries, we would do a strawberry-flavored vodka, but really tied to some of the local farmers and what they're producing near us.
Why did you think this would be a good venture to get into, Garrett?
Really, from some of the work that you know Jeff and others had done, our feeling is it's uniquely local. It's something that hasn't been done for a while. A lot of people think when you say distillery that it's a you know large industry and you know it doesn't happen on that local level. And now with some of the law changes and things like that, you're able to put a distillery down the street just like you have a microbrew. And I think folks' interest in having a better product that isn't mass-produced and is tied to you know some place that they know they can go visit, they can see how it's done. I really think education in the consumer has played a big part.
So this new law taking effect today, July 1st, heavily influenced your decision to found this new distillery?
Definitely. You know, the tourism aspect for us and creating that local tie, really that personal connection between the distiller and the consumer was big for us.
Mm-hmm. So spin this out a little bit. Do you imagine that there's much, I mean, will we have the, now two distilleries in Iowa. We have Cedar Ridge in Swisher, and we have Templeton Rye out in western Iowa. Yours will be coming online, Mississippi River Distilling Company. How many more distilleries will there be in Iowa in the coming years, you imagine?
You know, I don't know that I would throw out a number, but I think the trend nationwide is that, you know, there's plenty of room. Actually, in just researching, you know, before Prohibition, there were, you know, hundreds of thousands of distilleries throughout the country that, that really made up the market, and that's how Europe is, you know, today. I really think that, you know, to see, you know, three or four pop up over the next few years wouldn't be out of line.
Jeff, let me ask Jeff Quint quickly that same question before we go to the break. So in a number of communities across Iowa, you would imagine distilleries all over the like we have microbrews all over the state now.
Yeah, I agree. I think you'll see a few more, you know, micro distilleries, and then I think as a result of the micro distilleries, you'll probably see over time a couple of larger production facilities that might come out of that.
Okay, we want to ask our listeners to join our conversation. If you have a question for Jeff Quint or Garrett Burchett, 1-866-780-9100 about distilled spirits as we mark today the first bourbon whiskey made from Iowa corn and distilled in the state after the end of Prohibition, making its debut today. And that's why we're having this discussion. And you can join it, 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100 or email us, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Twitter at IPR Talk. When we come back, I want to ask, what exactly is bourbon? What makes bourbon bourbon? And how do you make bourbon? When we come back, how do you judge the taste of a bourbon whiskey? Also, tastes of other distilled liquors. When we come back, this is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. Back with The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Jeff Quint is with us, president and owner of Cedar Ridge Vineyards, Winery, and Distillery in Swisher, Iowa, as is Garrett Burchett, one of the investors in the Mississippi River Distilling Company in LeClaire, Iowa, hoping to be in production this fall. Any questions about distilling spirits? 1-866-780-9100. So let's talk to you first of all, Jeff Quint. What is the definition of bourbon whiskey? What makes it? What makes bourbon bourbon?
Well, you know, first of all, bourbon is a whiskey, so we're dealing with grains, and specifically, bourbon has to be made from at least 51% corn. And as I mentioned earlier, we're closer to 70 to 75% corn. So it's that 51% corn that makes it bourbon. The other thing that's unique about bourbon is bourbon must be aged in new American oak barrels. So the other thing that's happening out at our distillery is every time we make more bourbon, we have to get more new barrels. And when those barrels, when we empty the barrels to do a bottling, we can't refill them with bourbon. We can refill them with whiskey, but we can't refill them with bourbon because by law that's a used barrel now.
So what's getting used up in the barrel going from new to used oak?
That's a good question, and I think I'm going to answer that by saying that I believe corn is just a little bit harsher product going into barrel, typically a little sharper edged product than, say, a malted barley. So if you're in Scotland and you're making scotch, you're making basically a single malt barley product. Almost all of that, I shouldn't say almost all that, a lot of that product is going into used bourbon barrels. In Kentucky, when they empty a bourbon barrel, they ship the bulk of those to Scotland, and that becomes a barrel for making scotch. Mm-hmm. And I think malted barley prefers maybe a little – it's a little more delicate. It prefers a used barrel that's been conditioned a little bit, where corn can handle that freshly charred surface inside that barrel and actually benefits from the additional I guess I'd call it filtration that occurs as that bourbon sits in that barrel, and it goes in and out of that the surface of that barrel as it heats up and cools down, and basically it's going through a kind of a mini filtration process with the carbon that's burnt into the inside of that
barrel. Okay, so the inside of the slats they are charred.
They're charred. They're literally rough. When we get those, if you turn them upside down and shake them, you'll see basically charcoal pouring out, or not pouring out, but
maybe
dust.
maybe this is a myth to be busted, but I heard that bourbon was first made when somebody's house burned down, a cabin burned down, and somebody built barrels out of it and put a distilled liquor in that. Is any truth to that?
I'm willing to go with that.
You're willing. Have you heard anything about that, Garrett?
I have not, but again, I'll go with anything.
Something has to go in a new barrel. So,
tell us about this Bavarian pot still that is used. You use it for a whole bunch of different spirits that you have there. You've mm-hmm. got vodka, gin, grappa, apple brandy, dark rum. All can be made with the same. Still.
Yeah, if you come see the new equipment we just put in, it's all custom built for us out of Göppingen, Germany, and it's. It's one of a kind, and it has several columns. So there's one pot, but we can channel the product as it comes out of the pot, as it vaporizes. We can channel it into several different columns and configure those columns differently so we can make a wide variety of products. We did start out, as I mentioned, with vodka, gin, and then we moved to the brandies, and then more recently into the whiskey.
Mm-hmm. Describe the taste of your whiskey. I assume you've tasted it.
The bourbon? Sure.
Yeah, sure.
Sure. Well, I would say that our bourbon is an excellent example of what we're capable of creating here in Iowa. When you taste it, it's clearly bourbon. It's a solid player in the bourbon space. It's smooth. I mean, you're going to have a smoothness or a sharpness. When bourbon first comes out of the still, it's very sharp. It's that barrel aging and filtration that smooths that
sharpness away. And the charring does what to it? It's mingling with the charred.
The char creates kind of a glaze around the inside of the barrel that does a couple of things. You might say it sweetens it a little bit over time, and then also acts as filtration because there's basically activated carbon in that char, and that activated carbon acts as a filter. The other thing about the bourbon is from a viscosity or mouthfeel standpoint, very viscous, nice, hearty bourbon. Maybe not quite like a Maker's Mark, but there's certainly some of that mouthfeel to it.
Mm-hmm. In this first batch, how many barrels are there available? Bottles,
yeah.
Cases, whatever you. How are we going to measure it here?
What we're able to do as of July 1st is every month we have enough bourbon supply now to release 250 cases a month. Unfortunately, we're in a position where we're going to have to allocate it because we you put it in a barrel and it's ready when it's ready. And you know what we're making now is so far into the future that we already know for the rest of 2010 what we have available. Mm-hmm. And based on our estimates, we should be able to release about 250 cases a month. So those are going around the state right now, and they will run out. We shipped it to the state yesterday, and I think the state will be out of it by next week. But that means the stores in Iowa will have it. You know, we'll have it available from time to time, and hopefully it'll be just about the right amount for the state.
Tell us about the events that are taking place today and
sure.
over the weekend, because you're marking
yep.
this event, new bourbon with some events as well. People can
yep.
come out and visit?
Yeah, we're celebrating both the release of the bourbon and the significance of the new law change for the next 4 days, starting today, out at Cedar Ridge. We have blues and barbecue going all weekend, live music tonight, tomorrow night, all through the weekend. Chef Aiden Wheat is out there whipping up barbecue for everybody starting later this afternoon, and he'll be there through the whole weekend. So you can come out, sample the bourbon, buy a bottle until we run out, and then also sample our other spirits and wines as well.
Now, Garrett Burchett, your new distillery is being constructed now. When you make the distillery, how much of the design is with the thought of having tourists there?
Actually, it's a majority of our design. It was also why we picked our location. It was looking for a place that, you know, small town Iowa that had the downtown forming our building around that feel, and basically having a older style of exterior. But as you walk into our building and working with the architect, creating a flow around, you know, both the tasting room, a retail area, and then also the still. You'll actually be able to walk by the distillery and see the still, both on the riverside and then on the street side. So really, it was a huge focus for us.
Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, too, as we lead into this discussion about Al Capone coming up. Of course, Al Capone, a big name in the Prohibition era, with nearly 80 years after the end of Prohibition. How would you characterize our society's attitude toward alcohol? Not too long ago, we were at a point where we wanted to made alcohol illegal for some period. Jeff Quint, your thoughts on that?
Well, I'm not sure our attitude towards alcohol has changed much over the last century. I think it has more to do with government regulation and taxes. I think the government couldn't necessarily control prohibition, so they decided to control the distribution and of course taxing of it.
Right.
As an alternative. That seems to have worked out pretty well.
Garrett Burchett, very quickly before we go to a break, any thoughts on that?
You know, I would agree. I think, you know, we've kind of been unchanged. I think the real thing that I mentioned earlier, that, you know, the education has really changed, and people are looking for a finer spirit than they have in the past, and it's really driving some of the things that we've seen in the industry in the last few years.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Garrett Burchett, one of the investors in Mississippi River Distilling Company, being constructed in LeClaire, Iowa. I guess it would be Iowa's third distillery. Are you going to be number three, Garrett?
Hopefully. That's
okay.
The plan.
Very good. Jeff Quint with us, president owner of the Cedar Ridge Vineyards Winery and Distillery, Iowa's first distillery. Thank you very much, Jeff, for coming by.
Thank you.
When we come back, we travel back to the Prohibition era in the Midwest with Jonathan Eich. His new biography is titled Get Capone, the secret plot that captured America's most wanted gangster. That's when we return. This is Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back with The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Tomorrow on this program, a conversation with University of Iowa President Sally Mason. Dean Borg will be sitting in the chair talking about the university's efforts to recover from the floods of 2008 and the economic recession. Also, a discussion about recent changes in the Big Ten Conference and the role of sports revenue. Later in the hour tomorrow, a talk about rural issues in Iowa with a representative from the USDA. It's The Exchange on Friday. Today, we're continuing our bootleg edition of the exchange, so to speak. And we continue with the story of Al Capone, America's most iconic gangster, a story that has been told many times in books, films, and on television. But according to my next guest, the tales of Capone's notorious criminal career and law enforcement's efforts to bring him down have been larded with half-truths and outright fabrications. Jonathan Eig is the author of two New York Times best-selling biographies, Luckiest Man, The Life and Death of Lou Gehrig, and Opening Day, The Story of Jackie Robinson's First Season. Both books have won several awards. Jonathan Eig's latest biography is titled Get Capone, The Secret Plot That Captured America's Most Wanted Gangster. Jonathan Eig joins us by phone from Chicago, the home, well, the adopted home of Al Capone, I guess I have to say. Good afternoon, Jonathan.
Good afternoon. It's nice to talk to you.
Nice. I guess he grew up in New York City and moved as a young man to Chicago, where you are now.
That's right.
Start off by reminding us who Al Capone was and what he controlled at the height of his power.
Well, he was, as you said, a New Yorker, born in Brooklyn, came to Chicago just at the moment that Prohibition was taking effect, and he was 21 years old. It was his amazing good luck to be here at that time, because without Prohibition, I think he would have remained really a two-bit thug, a bouncer, a bartender, maybe working as a truck driver. But Prohibition put an incredible opportunity in front of him, and by the time he was 26, 27 years old, he was in charge of this massive operation to supply beer and alcohol to a city that obviously still wanted it. And, you know, most of the country was still drinking all through Prohibition, and there were just incredible opportunities to make money as a result of that. And many, many people became wealthy and powerful as a result of their willingness to violate the law of Prohibition. Al Capone is almost certainly the most prominent and most celebrated of those outlaws.
Mm-hmm. Tell us, in dollar terms, how big his empire was. What was he bringing in per year at his height, in today's terms, perhaps?
In today's terms, I would guess that his organization was bringing in, you know, tens of millions of dollars a year, which meant for Capone personally, hundreds of thousands of dollars into his own pocket. But it's very hard because it was such a loosely run business and it was all done in cash. It was very difficult to get a good feel for how much money was involved. And that's part of the reason why when the feds finally got around to prosecuting him on an income tax evasion charge, they had such a difficult time because nobody knew how much money the guy actually made.
Mm-hmm. So what are the main ways in which your biography departs from previous biographies of Al Capone?
Well, I think a couple of things. First of all, Capone has usually been made out as a monster, as a psychopath, and I tried to show that he was really, sort of a grunt, a fairly ambitious, fairly talented guy who was in the right place at the right time, but in no way resembled any psychopathic behavior. And I also was able to get access to documents that nobody had seen before, including thousands of pages of government materials on the Capone investigation that showed that he was really a scapegoat for the government, that in Herbert Hoover's attempt to enforce the prohibition laws and to show the nation that he was tough on crime, he wanted to make an example of Al Capone, and the case that they built against Capone was surprisingly shaky.
Mm-hmm. So the directive to get Capone came from President Hoover himself. And what did President Hoover hope to gain by stopping Capone?
Well, it was interesting because Hoover took office right after the Valentine's Day massacre, so there was a great deal of outrage about these gang wars and how many people were dying and how no one was ever prosecuted for these crimes. But Hoover felt there was a bigger problem, and that was that Prohibition had corrupted the nation's justice system. All throughout the country, not just in Chicago, bootleggers were getting away with these crimes, and juries were disinclined to convict. So you didn't want to rat or you didn't even want to serve on a jury if one of your neighbors was making whiskey in his basement or in his barn. And the courts fell apart because of this, because people who were obviously guilty were just getting off scot-free. So Hoover wanted to remake the justice system. He wanted to reestablish some sense of order in this country. And he had a long and complicated plan for how he would do that. But he also wanted to send a message so that people would see that he was doing something, and he needed a symbol. That symbol was Al Capone. So he made Al Capone sort of the the advertisement, the promotional figure, the scapegoat, you may say, for all of the problems that he saw.
Mm-hmm. So what you're saying up to this point is Al Capone was certainly celebrated, but you also call him a two-bit thug who came along at the right time. What made him into the celebrity that he became?
Well, that's where I think Capone really made his biggest mistake. He embraced the media. He loved the attention, and he wanted to be a celebrity. Now, that might sound strange for a guy who's making his living by breaking the law and who's killing his rivals and openly selling booze when it's against the law to do so. But you have to remember, too, that it's the 1920s, and celebrity culture is booming. You've got people sitting on flagpoles. You've got Lucky Lindbergh flying across the Atlantic, and Babe Ruth is not just a baseball player anymore. He's this symbol of debauchery. And Al Capone sees all this happening and thinks, well, why can't I be a celebrity gangster? Why can't I go above ground and just admit that this is what I do? He starts giving interviews. He allows his picture to be put on the cover of magazines, and he becomes the symbol of this broken law of prohibition, and he just flaunts it in a shocking way, really.
Mm-hmm. And that's how he gets on President Hoover's radar.
Exactly, because every city in America had a bootlegger like Al Capone. I can rattle off the names for you, and some of them were bigger and more successful than Al Capone, but they all kept their names out of the newspapers. Capone was different, and even before he went to jail, even while he was still in power, people were writing books and making movies about him. There were novels based on his career. The newspapers just loved this guy, and he was an international star before he was 30 years old.
Jonathan Eig is my guest for the remainder of the hour. His latest biography is titled Get Capone, The Secret Plot That Captured America's Most Wanted Gangster. If you have a question or a comment about Al Capone, 1-866-780-9100. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. You can email us, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. Now, what seems to set your book apart is that you use some previously untapped government work materials that belong to a man we never heard of, George E.Q. Johnson, a U.S. attorney for the Northern District of Illinois at the time. How did you come upon these materials?
Well, they were in the possession of the family for a long time. When Johnson, who was an Iowan, by the way, who came to Chicago to study law and stayed in Chicago, when Johnson retired, he did not turn his papers over to the National Archives. There was no such thing as the National Archives yet. He kept them all, and his son preserved them. And then his son, years and years ago, handed these papers off to a professor in Nebraska, and hoping that this professor in Nebraska would write a book about George Johnson. The book was never completed, and I was able to get a hold of these documents. And they were thousands and thousands of pages of the government's original work materials on Capone. So you've got wiretaps of the Capone gang. You've got memos from the Justice Department, from the White House, all going over their frustrations and why it's so difficult for them to put Capone away.
Mm-hmm. So what did these? What were the most surprising things that these work materials brought to light that hadn't been revealed thus far about Capone?
I think the biggest thing was that it showed just how cautious Capone was about how he really built this business in a way that made him completely bulletproof. There was no way to prove that he was doing any of this stuff.
He never did the dirty work.
That's right. Yeah, he was very careful. He not only handed off the murder assignments and built in several layers, but he also never touched the money. And there was nothing in his own name, no businesses in his name, no checks written to him. He was incredibly shrewd about that. And his only mistake was not paying his taxes. But even then, these documents show that the tax case was fraught with problems, that the feds really believed up until the last minute that Capone might beat the charges, and they were prepared to make a deal with him for a very light sentence. They were ready to plea bargain this thing and make it go away because they were afraid that they were going to be embarrassed to go to court and to lose to Al Capone.
Now, you credit this Iowan, this U.S. attorney for the Northern District of Illinois at the time, George Johnson, as the man behind Capone's conviction. So why have Elliot Ness and his group of untouchables gotten so much of the credit for bringing down Capone if they didn't have anything to do with it, or did they?
Well, they had very little to do with it. Elliot Ness was a bit player. He was working for George Johnson, and he was out there trying to find evidence that Capone was selling booze, and he did manage to shut down some operations, some breweries and some distilleries, and you know, he would always call the newspapers and get a lot of attention for his raids. But the raids never amounted to anything. They never connected him to connected these operations to Capone. So he found no evidence that proved useful to the U.S. attorney, to George Johnson. So my guess is that I'm fairly certain that Al Capone never met Elliot Ness and probably never even heard of him. So I think that the reason Elliot Ness became famous is because he had a good ghostwriter. Years later, he told his story very modestly in a very short book that he wrote, but the ghostwriter took that little book and turned it into magic. And that book got turned into the TV show starring Robert Stack and then the movie starring Kevin Costner. And, you know, to tell the Capone story, you need a good guy. You need, and preferably it's a good guy who's doing something physical and putting his life on the line. And that's why, you know, George Johnson and these accountants didn't make good heroes for the movies. But the truth is that Elliot Ness was almost entirely invented.
Jonathan Eig is the author of the new book, the new biography, Get Capone, The Secret Plot That Captured America's Most Wanted Gangster. So you mentioned one Iowa connection here, George Johnson. Of course, Iowa neighboring Illinois. What connections did Capone and his organization have to Iowa in this era of bootlegging and prohibition?
Well, I think Iowa was a source for some of the booze that came into Chicago, and Iowans made some of the whiskey and rye since there was the grain was so abundant, and all you really needed to make this stuff was a good spot to hide it, and there's plenty of room in Iowa in barns where you can hide these. And I think people in Iowa still probably talk about some of the better stills and where they were. And so I think Capone definitely got some of his alcohol from Iowa, and that meant he was doing business with some Iowans. He may have traveled there on some of these business trips, but I never found any proof, hard proof that Capone spent time there. He certainly had men who had operations in Iowa. I would say, Dubuque and some of the other cities on the border were places where Capone's men would make trips. But I don't know whether Capone himself ever made it to Iowa.
You were the first writer to draw on some newly released prison records and personal letters that Capone wrote to his family while in prison after his tax evasion conviction. He was sent to the island of Alcatraz off the West Coast. What new things do these letters reveal about Capone the man?
They're interesting. You know, Capone in his last years when he was in prison, he went to jail. He was only 32 years old when he was sentenced. And he spent 8 years in jail, so 32 to age 40 roughly. And he was diagnosed with syphilis when he first got to the penitentiary. He went to Atlanta first before he went to Alcatraz. And he was diagnosed with tertiary syphilis, which meant that by then it had invaded his neurological system and was starting to affect his brain. And the treatments that he received were radical and experimental and very nearly killed him. At the same time, while his mind is going and while he's undergoing these violent treatments, he's also a model prisoner. And he has moments of sanity where he's writing these beautiful, heartfelt letters to his wife and to his mother, apologizing for the pain that he brought his family. He's writing to his son and begging his son to stay in college and make a good career for himself. He's also learning to play a musical instrument, the mandola, and learning to write songs. So it was a fascinating time to see this man really sinking and starting to deteriorate with this disease, and at the same time attempting to atone for some of his sins. He starts going to church for the first time. It's a strange and dark period for Capone.
How many years did it take you to do this book, Jonathan?
I spent about 3 years working on it, and I was able to not only get those materials from George Johnson, but I was able to persuade the IRS for the first time to release their records on the tax investigation of Capone. And I found Capone's relatives who were willing to talk for the first time. You know, for many years, the Capone family were embarrassed, and they, many of them changed their names. And I think enough time has gone by that some of them, at least, were willing to talk about.
So there are people out there now in the U.S. named with the last name Capone who are direct descendants of Al Capone.
Many of them have changed their name, but there are still a few named Capone, they are quite lovely people who feel like their family has gotten a bad rap through history because of. This man and this notorious reputation that he has. But in fact, two of his sisters-in-law are still alive. These are women who were married to Capone's brothers. Capone had a big family, and many of his nieces and nephews are still around, and some of his grandchildren are still out there.
After spending 3 years researching Al Capone, digging up these documents, speaking to living relatives of Al Capone, if you could have dinner with him, America's most notorious gangster. Let's suppose he's not going to do you any harm, so you can ask him any questions. What would you want to ask him?
Oh, man, I would love to sit down to dinner with him. And I don't think I'd be too scared as long as I had no business interests with him.
Okay.
But I think I'd like to ask him what he feels his biggest mistake was and where he went wrong, because I think so much of what he ended up doing in life was almost accidental. He happened to be in the booze business when Prohibition began, and it wasn't by choice. Certainly at a certain point, he has to take responsibility for his actions and his willingness to not only be a criminal, but to be a violent criminal. But where did he feel like, what was the turning point? That's what I'd probably like to start by asking him.
The turning point to what? To great?
From being a provider for your family and feeling like you're doing a job to being a menace, to being a villain, and where does the greed come in? At what point does it feel more like taking advantage and as opposed to trying to support your family, which is what he always claimed he was just doing?
Mm-hmm. There are many colorful, often grisly anecdotes in your book. Tell us a favorite anecdote of yours from Al Capone.
Well, as I said earlier, Capone really most of the time managed to avoid getting involved personally in the violence. But early in his career, he didn't have that luxury. And very early on in Chicago, before he was a household name, one of his top men, one of his best friends, Jack Guzik, was beat up in a bar. Jack Guzik was the accountant for the mob, and he was this roly-poly guy, couldn't hurt a fly. And some guy in a bar knocked him around and slapped him and taunted him and called him all kinds of names and then bragged about how he'd made the fat Jew whimper, he said. And Capone went after this guy, found him in a bar, grabbed him by the lapels and just held him there, held a gun to his head and said, "Who's whimpering now?" And then blew his brains out. And it's a grisly scene, but I think it was a key moment for Capone's career, because it sent a message to the other people who he worked with that Capone was loyal and that he took care of his men. And I think that Capone didn't have to kill a lot of people in his career to prove he was tough, but that was an early indication of what was to come.
Speaking of grisly, of course, Capone has long been considered the mastermind behind the St. Valentine's Day Massacre, perhaps the most famous mob killing in history. There were 7 people. Many of them involved in different mobs and mafia in a garage in Chicago. But you say Capone is innocent of this action?
The Valentine's Day Massacre is probably the greatest unsolved crime in American history. And
Tell us what happened briefly.
Yeah, 7 men are killed in a garage on Clark Street on the north side of Chicago, and they were mostly members of the Bugs Moran gang. And Bugs Moran's men were rivals to Al Capone's men. So as the crime went unsolved, it was, and there were some police men dressed as police officers who were seen going into the garage at the time of the murder. So at first, people thought cops did it, which was certainly plausible. Cops were often getting into fights with these gangsters, over money. The cops were expecting to get paid, or the cops took a load of liquor off of some bootleggers. So the first theory was that the cops may have killed these men in the garage. Then there were theories that it was one gang or another. And eventually, the longer it went unsolved, everybody just assumed that it was Al Capone who had perpetrated this or had ordered it because he wanted to get Bugs Moran out of the way. But I should mention Bugs Moran was not in the garage that day. He was not one of the men killed. So I came across a letter in the FBI archives that has an entirely different and new theory for what happened that day, and I think it's by far the most intriguing and logical explanation, and it's simple in that it says that it was an act of revenge, that a cop's son was killed by some members of the Moran gang, and that the cop's family came after these guys who killed the cop's son. And that would explain the passion. That would explain why they were willing to mow down everybody in the garage that day. It would explain the police uniforms. It explains a lot of things. Does that mean that we've definitively solved the crime? No, but I think it's a terrific new theory.
We have about a minute left, Jonathan Eich. What would Al Capone? What do you imagine he would be doing today, in today's world, in an era when we don't have prohibition? Would he be a drug lord?
You know, it's possible that he'd be a drug lord, but I suspect that...
or a CEO. How about a CEO?
Or how about a Chicago alderman? I think he would have been well-suited for politics, to be honest, certainly at the local level, because he was a very gregarious guy, and he was also a guy who was very good at organizing, community organizer in his own way. So who knows?
Community organizer. Oh boy. That phrase jumped out at me. All right. Maybe the next president then, huh?
That I doubt. I don't think so. But he definitely had some potential.
Jonathan Eich, thank you very much for this conversation. Jonathan Eich, the author of the new biography, Get Capone, The Secret Plot That Captured America's Most Wanted Gangster. Jonathan, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
The Exchange is produced by Alex Hoyer, Catherine Perkins, and Jeff Schmidt. Production assistance today from Lindsay Moon. Technical support from Dennis Reese. Podcasting and on-demand audio available by going to iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by Dan Knight. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.